Ladies and gentlemen, 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, and as usual, that means it's time for the other podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
And I'm not. Hi, folks. It's John Hoke here, the other guy on the other podcast. Stacy blogs at theothermccain.com. And he will admit to that.
And you can find John Hoke's excellent work at hogwash.com.
Whereas Diana, who is lurking in Valdosta, does not blog so much, do you, young lady?
I blog about nonprofit world on my own little site, and that's not real exciting to anybody who ain't in it. So.
On the other hand, somebody who might need assistance with that would do well to go to that site and check you
out. Absolutely.
What's the URL?
The URL is dealyadvancement.com.
And folks should go there if they are trying to get their act together in the nonprofit world. Meanwhile, Stacy just can't get his act together at all. Stacy's problem is...
I've got a problem? Yeah. I didn't know I had a problem.
Stacy? Squirrel.
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 Yes, I have an attention span problem. For the past 2 days, the liberal media have been acting as if Ted Cruz's vacation to Cancun was the biggest news story of the week. Mm-hmm. Scott McKay, writing in the American Spectator, points out this is a squirrel distraction. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Those of you who've never had a dog like a Springer Spaniel like I had for a while, you could just say the word squirrel in conversation and she'd be right at the nearest window looking.
Well, Scott points out that it was Michelle Malkin at least popularized squirrel as the name for this media distraction technique, where they all jump on the same story and treat it like it's the most important thing in the world. But it's intended to draw the public's attention away from the COVID-19 scandal around Andrew Cuomo.
Can we
and
use the
other
word
news
engulfing?
That,
please use
what?
The word engulfing. Engulfing. The scandal engulfing. Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
I like that picture.
I like my good choice of verbs there. Yes.
Yeah. But for the past week or two, the scandal, if you don't know what I'm talking about, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, it has been revealed that he concealed the true number of nursing home deaths
that were caused by the fact that he required patients to be returned to nursing homes.
Yeah, it was a result of his policy at a time when the federal government, but you know, Donald Trump was sending everything he had. Okay, everything we had went to New York. You remember this.
There was a hospital ship parked in the harbor, the
Javits Center,
who had been turned into a military field hospital.
And they sat empty because
they had 20 patients aboard the Comfort.
Yeah, but the New York officials did not want to cooperate with Trump and give him any credit, see. And so this became, so the whole while the media was, they actually gave Andrew Cuomo an Emmy Award for his I guess his television performances.
Well, what do you expect, a Nobel Prize?
right. But it turns out that that they were hiding the numbers in order to blame Trump. It was politics straight up.
You're trying to tell me that a New York politician lied?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's
somehow exactly. That's believable.
Anyways, but I just saw on Twitter someone tweeted out everybody that's pretending to be outraged over Cruz in Cancun gave this a complete pass. Mm-hmm. And it's a picture of a particular Oldsmobile 88 submerged in the water. I think you know who was behind the wheel of that
Oldsmobile. Summer of 69, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, Mary Jo Kopechne is not available for comment.
Yes. No. And so,
at least, but you know what? The numbers will add up eventually on Mr. Cuomo, I'm sure. But then again, numbers are racist. I had another one of my don't know much about algebra posts. Now, for those of you who are not old enough, I'm so old, I actually remember playing as a disc jockey, Wonderful World by Sam Cooke. You know, don't know much about history. That one, yeah.
Well, don't know much biology.
Right.
Don't know much about a science book.
We'll get to that one in a second. But right
don't
now,
don't know much about the French I took.
Well, we're getting to the second stanza.
I can't sing as good as Sam Cooke. He was the
very
the,
few was people great. Can.
He was the greatest, Sam Cooke.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of greatness touched this particular song. One of the songwriters was Herb Alpert.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but I do know that I love you.
Yeah. But that was the back in the days when he was playing sessions as a trumpet player and then producing, working as an A&R guy. Which mm-hmm. funniest thing, you know, he wound up calling his record company A&R.
But meanwhile,
don't know much about algebra. This is about your racism wanting the numbers to add up, Stacey. Fox reported initially that I saw it, but it's been all over now, that the Oregon Department of Education is trying to undo white supremacy in math education. Really? Mm. And the mini course they're offering to teachers, and this is a quote from the ODE's flyer, includes a list of ways, quote, white supremacy culture, unquote, allegedly, quote, infiltrates math classrooms. These include, quote, the focus on getting the right answer, unquote. Students will be, quote, required to show their work and other alleged manifestations. The concept of mathematics being purely objective is unequivocally false.
What?
And teaching it is even much less so, the document for the Equitable Math Toolkit reads. Upholding the idea that there's always right and wrong answers perpetuate objectivity as well as sphere of open conflict. You know, I wonder how many of the education bureaucrats who are pushing that crap would be upset if I recalculated their paychecks based on the principle that 2 + 2 = 3.
Yeah, as I remarked on my blog about it, arithmetic is now white supremacy. Objectivity.
I mean, and there are going to be a whole bunch of Africans, i.e. Egyptians, who invented the basis of the counting system we use like 4,000 years ago, who are unavailable for comment on this.
Well, you know, the interesting the fact is that if math is white supremacy, why are Asians so good at it? this is the thing, see, is that for some reason it's white supremacy to think that there's a right answer to a math problem.
People, I hear chuckling going on in the background, but 60 years ago when I was in high school, The best students in my math class were either Asians or Jews.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, my remark was
they've been they've been promoted to become honorary crackers, I suppose, because they're good in math.
And hey, now that 1984 is an instruction manual. Okay. 2 + 2 is whatever the party needs it to be.
Right.
This is easy
very
to
good,
become
Winston
sane.
Smith. Yes, but anyways, as I said, if you wonder what's wrong with America, start with the schools.
Well, see, but here's the problem. What's wrong with this is they're talking about the problem with it is objectivity. The problem with it is truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is pure Marxism, where nothing is really based in truth. It's based in power. It's what mm-hmm. I can get. It's mm-hmm. what my side can get. And, you know, the problem is things get too intersectional, and now you wind up having to share, which is one of the reasons why Margaret Thatcher was correct in her observation that the problem with socialism is you always run out of other people's money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just doesn't work. There was another post I had at Hogwash about the fight for the $15 minimum wage. And by the way, I just got in the email. I mean, like 5 minutes before we went on this evening, I just got an email from a group called Our Revolution Organized to Win, and it's got a big picture of Bernie saying a $15 minimum wage is not a radical idea. What's radical is the fact that millions of Americans are forced to work for starvation wages, while 650 billionaires became over $1 trillion richer during the global pandemic.
What does that even mean?
I'm not sure, but, you know... There was a post by a fellow by the name of Reverend William Barber over at In These Times about the fight for the $15 minimum wage and it being a fight for racial justice.
No.
And the preacher starts with a very loose quote from the beginning of the 10th chapter of Isaiah. Woe to those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights, who make women and children their prey. Actually, it's widows and orphans their prey. That's in the Hebrew. But anyway, you know, I agree with the good reverend that those of us who are in better circumstances have an obligation to treat the poor justly and to be compassionate in our care for widows and orphans. You know, I mean, and that's kind of like a no-brainer for a Christian like me. However, I believe the minimum wage increase that he supports will hurt rather than help the poor, and that actually it would be passing that law would be legislating evil. Because the general effect of a minimum wage is to price workers with marginal skills out of the labor market. Businesses don't have a bottomless fund that they pay wages out of. You can only extract so much revenue from your customers, and you got to take that money and divide it among the rent and inventory and wages and other expenses that you have. Mm-hmm. And a minimum wage bill doesn't make those other expenses like rent go away.
No, right? Actually, it raises them. And it also reduces your customer base because you raise your prices, your customers can't afford your stuff anymore because everything else is getting more expensive too. The logic is simple.
But even in a non-dynamic situation, if you just had the same pool of cash, now you still got to pay the rent, you still got to pay the electric bill, and now you still got the same amount of money to pay employees with, and if you have to pay every employee more, I know this is racist arithmetic, but, you know, the way the math works is you have to have fewer employees.
Exactly.
So, you know, so people wind up losing jobs. Businesses won't grow. And not every worker gonna that loses his job, though, because the minimum wage is actually going to be out of work. They're going to go in the black economy and be working off the books, which means they won't be accruing any Social Security benefits, for example. So, you know, when you need
money to put food on the table, you do what you have to do.
Absolutely. I've worked three jobs before because that's what it took. Mm-hmm. You know, we Americans generally believe that everyone's got the right to work to support himself and his family. Mm-hmm. And is it just to pass a law that artificially prices poor people out of the labor market? I don't think so. But that's go ahead.
Have none of these people read Ludwig von Mises or Friedrich Hayek?
They probably don't know who either of them are.
Okay. Let me explain something very simple. Okay, Hayek made this clear. Ludwig von Mises, and I believe it was 1924, 7 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, mm-hmm. pointed out that socialism was doomed to fail because mm-hmm. socialism eliminates prices. Okay, Hayek took this a little bit further and explained that prices are information. Okay, this is feedback. Okay, the market economy works on the basis of information. You have to think of prices as information.
Using logic and reason again.
Okay.
What you hear from the opponents of this is that this is a myth. Oh no, it's nonsense. The Chicago Institute of Economics proved it in one of their forums. So you have to deal with that too.
Okay. The point is this, is that what went wrong with the Soviet Union was the command economy. Okay. It was everything. The idea that bureaucrats are better, it can determine what should be produced and in what quantities, regardless. See, whereas the market, it is price that determines production. Okay. In other words, if the price of something is going up, okay, that tells you that there's more demand and therefore more of it will be produced. What they're trying to do is price fixing. Okay. Mm-hmm. And every time you do this, the result is a shortage. Okay. Price fixing causes shortages.
Well, it either causes a shortage or it makes the thing artificially valuable and then there's too much of it and a glut of it. And there's a wonderful exercise that we do in engineering school in our automatic control classes about what happens when you break feedback mechanisms. And price is the feedback mechanism that regulates the temperature of the economy, just like the thermostat on the wall behind you regulates the temperature here in the room. You take thermostat out of here and let the heating system run open loop, and it may not keep up, or it may during the weather right now, but 6 months from now, it's going to be real hot in here and we're not going to like it.
Wages are prices. Okay. It is the price at which you sell your labor. Okay. Right. This is, and the idea that by raising the minimum wage, you somehow benefit people.
No, you price them out of the market.
Yes.
Hang on a second. Let me tell you a personal story.
Okay.
Okay. For several years during the Reagan administration, okay, the minimum wage did not rise at all. Okay. True. It was $3.25 for a long time. When it started out, I was making $3.25 an hour. Okay. All right. And I was so happy when I got to the point to where I was making $6.50 an hour. I had succeeded. I was now earning twice the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And guess what they did? They raised the minimum wage. They raised the floor underneath me so that all that I had achieved by my own labor, you see, was eradicated by government action. And it is those people who work hard to get ahead. Okay. And, you know, $6.50 an hour is not, you know, you're not upper class when you're making $6.50.
No, but that was a decent middle class wage 35 years ago.
Well, I mean, you could get by.
Yeah.
You could get by. And so I was so happy. But you see, it was Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, who explained that all wealth is derived from one of three sources: the rent of land, the wages of labor, mm-hmm. or the interest of capital. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are only three sources of wealth. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so by trying to fix one element of this formula, you know, to dictate a minimum wage, you're throwing the entire machinery of the economy out of whack.
Well, you know, but see, a lot of these people, first of all, have never earned a minimum wage job. Some of them have been paid a whole lot more than minimum wage. The question is, what have they earned? But that's, you know, The whole thing, though, with your problem, Stacy, is not only have these people not read Hayek, I'm not sure that they've read Carroll, as in Lewis Carroll. So they don't understand your Anglo-Saxon attitudes.
Yeah, I have a post up. It's near the top of the blog over at The Other McCain called Erasing America's Anglo-Saxon
don't
Heritage.
Don't know much about history.
Yes, yeah. And the headline, I illustrate it with a screen grab of a Breitbart.com article that's very interesting. It's from 2019, and it's about academics in England trying to erase the term Anglo-Saxon from the study of history, claiming that it is, quote, inextricably bound up with pseudo-historical accounts of white supremacy, close quote. Now, this is in England, for crying out loud. Okay, the very word England comes from Anglo-Saxon. Okay, and if you will do a bit of research, you will find that that the British monk known as the Venerable Bede, mm-hmm. okay, used the phrase Anglo-Saxon as early as, I'm going to say it was like 800 or something like
earlier
this.
Six something.
Yeah, yeah. And so the point was is that King Edward, I think it was Edward the First, called himself Rex Anglo-Saxorum or what? Right. Okay. In other words, that he was the king of the Angles and the Saxons. Okay. Mm-hmm. The people who are teaching history are hostile to historic fact, and they use the phrase pseudo-historical accounts. No, the reality was, okay, if everyone would go to Amazon.com mm-hmm. and get Winston Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples.
I was getting ready to say these people not only haven't read Hayek and Carroll, they haven't read Churchill.
Okay, Churchill.
They didn't read Bede either.
Wrote a four-volume set called The History of the English Speaking Peoples.
And it kind of peters out about 1945 or six.
Yeah. Well, the point being that, yeah, he kind of got a little busy there.
Well, but, no, that's when he wrote it. He wrote it between then and 1950.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he had started it when
He did working on it for 50 years.
He spent decades working on it. And it is a straightforward history of the English people. And what you have to understand, Okay. When everyone's talking about oppression and colonialism and stuff like that, the history of England was determined by conquest. Okay. Mm-hmm. That the Romans conquered, even before the Romans conquered it, the Belgae conquered the island. The Celtic natives were like up in the hills and stuff, you know. But anyways, the Belgae conquered it. Then the Romans conquered it. And then when the Roman Empire was falling apart, that's when the Anglo-Saxons came in. Well, the Anglo-Saxons had, after a few generations, and the Anglo-Saxons, by the way, come from the vicinity of what is modern Hamburg, Germany. Okay. And the Jutes are a little bit farther up toward Denmark.
And then the Danes came.
Thus Jutland.
Yeah, well I was going to say is that a couple of hundred years later, the Vikings began their raids, especially on the eastern coast of England, so that what was known as the Danelaw was carved out in what is today known as East. What?
That's a little later. That's around later. 1000.
Yeah.
Danelaw is a bit later.
No. The East Anglia is.
Right, but that's not the Danelaw. Anyway, but
the point is the Norman conquest.
My family showed up in 1066.
Right. So yes, these Norsemen from across who had settled on the northern coast of modern day France, the Normans, Duke William of Normandy, then brought in another conquest, so that the whole history of England is bound up in these conquests. And so this idea that that somehow the European colonization of America was this terrible, terrible thing. It had happened to us. Okay.
It happens to everybody.
We ourselves had been conquered and colonized, and this was just the way it went.
The McCains are Scots, and you guys are the you're the people who kicked the picks out of Scotland.
Yeah, that there's all these this idea of a uniform whiteness, okay?
Yeah, right.
Which is right. This idea that all white people are in this sort of collective thing. This is a very modern idea.
You would have had trouble selling the idea that all those white Jews belonged in his country club if you were trying to make the pitch to Adolf Hitler.
Right.
My Irish ancestors.
Yep.
Yeah, the Irish hated the English.
We had reason.
I'm not saying you didn't have a reason, but you know, my folks were the Scots Irish, which is to say they were the Ulster Scots, as they were called.
They settled y'all on us.
We're talking about the facts of history.
Right. Exactly.
And that's what really happened. The thing is, there's a lot about nature that's factual, at which point I got to my third thing was don't know much about a science book. And in that case, Che Guevara had a tweet that said the infrastructure failures in Texas are quite literally what happens when you don't pursue a Green New Deal. No. The failures in Texas are what happens when, as a result of a pursuit of unreliable green energy sources instead of reliable science / technology / engineering based systems.
I pointed this out this week to my brother, as a matter of fact, is that when, whenever snow hit Georgia, and there was a blizzard back in 93 that was particularly bad that I remember. When it, you know, there you have all these Yankees laughing at Georgians who supposedly can't drive on the snow because, you know, everything gets shut down. And I explained that up here, right, when you're this far north, that maintaining a fleet of snow plows and salt trucks and everything like that, because it snows a lot up here, you know, it's a very fairly common occurrence, and so people are prepared for it, including, you know, these crews that go out and clear the roads it snows. And so, because of this preparedness, but the blizzard that we had in 93, that was a once in a lifetime sort of thing, and no one could have prepared for that.
Well, but I mean, it's interesting to seeing how things have changed a little bit because of our interconnectivity in society. Growing up in Nashville, when it snowed, literally the town shut down for until the snow went away. When I was a kid, they didn't even bother to try to clear the roads. Now they do because of the interstate system and that sort of stuff.
The point is that what happened in Texas is historic. This is a level of cold that has not been seen in 100 years.
It's at least a 100-year storm. It may be a 500-year storm.
Yeah, it is one of the and we're supposed to believe that this is climate change, right? This is global warming.
But here's the thing.
And so for them not to be prepared for this particular event is not really it's not really that bad.
Well, I mean, yes. Go ahead.
I do have one prepper friend who's the only thing that they were ready. They actually had all the primitive stuff, the extreme camping stuff, ready to go.
Yeah.
The only sad thing was that his wife's Viking gear was all in storage. Otherwise, there would have been a great photo op.
Yeah. Well, you know... I'm capable of just because of all my time in scouting and everything else, dealing with this sort of stuff. And I have a way of running the gas stove even when I don't have electricity and that sort of thing. So I'm not exactly a prepper, but I'm like I said, the Boy Scout motto is be prepared. But you know, at least what I've done is try to approach things realistically, looking at the facts. On the other hand, we've got our health agencies now being led by people who can't even figure out their own chromosomes.
Right. Yeah.
But they're gonna get us through this pandemic.
Yeah. I had a post this week called "Yes, China Caused This Pandemic." There'd been a lot of politics. Okay, that you're not allowed to speak the truth because the media, right, is sold out to China. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party is sold out to China. And so...
And Biden is now spelled with an X.
Yes. Anyways, Rahim Kassam at the National Pulse had an article citing... A University of Hamburg researcher, a very well-known and very well-established researcher named Roland Wiesentanger, I think I've pronounced that correctly, who concludes that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the cause of COVID-19. Now, this is most of us, right, because we're conservatives and seek out alternative media. Most of us know this. Okay, we already knew that the Wuhan.
I don't know it, but it's the way I'd bet, like 1,000 to 1 odds.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't know it in the same way I know my own name or something.
And well, anyways, he has put together a report that cites, and I'm trying to get the number here. He's a very prestigious scientist, by the way, but he cites 600 incontrovertible facts to bolster his theory that, quote, The number and the quality of evidence clearly indicates a laboratory accident at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Mm-hmm. The Wuhan lab carried out genetic manipulations on coronaviruses for many years with the aim of making them more contagious, dangerous, and deadly for humans, close quote. Now, this doesn't mean, and I have to emphasize this, this doesn't mean it was deliberate, okay, that the release of this virus was deliberate. What it means is that this was not any ordinary virus developed, developed naturally.
Here's the scary thing about it. What it most likely was the result of incompetence and carelessness. Yep. And if you look at socialist systems, mm-hmm. right, we had an incident at Three Mile Island. The mm-hmm. Soviet Union had an incident at Chernobyl.
Which was worse?
They had several before.
And yes, well, no, they've got more than one nuclear submarine on the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, they do. We have the Thresher too. Don't forget about that.
Yes, but it's not probably as a result of a nuclear accident.
No, it wasn't.
Whereas they have at least two that I'm aware of that were reactor meltdowns.
Yeah, you're right about that.
So, basically, you know, facts keep getting in the way. And it's so inconvenient for so many people. But we, on the other hand, embrace the facts. And since we embrace the facts, we try to deal with the universe as it is, which includes paying our bills. And in order to pay our bills, well, I've got a day job, but Stacy actually does this for a living, folks.
Yes.
And he has this yellow book.
Yes, folks, if you will go to my blog, theothermccain.com, near the top of the page, you will see the yellow button with the word donate on it. If you will click the yellow button, it'll take you to my PayPal account where you can contribute to the support of the blog and to the support of the podcast, of course. Meanwhile, over at my good friend John Hogue's blog, Hoguewash.com.
Indeed, I do have a day job, but I do this. Actually, I got into blogging 10 years ago coming up this July because I thought I was going to retire and wanted something to do. But I've been having a lot of fun and interesting experiences as a blogger. A lot of people have helped support the blog, and I've appreciated that. I have a tip jar lurking over in the sidebar of the blog there. And if you click on it, you'll be taken off to my PayPal account where you can help support the blog. Or you can go down and shop at the Hoguewash store, clicking on that icon of a silly looking hat. Or you can support both Hoguewash and the other McCain and lots of other bloggers around the interwebs who are members of the Amazon Associates Program. If you use those qualified links on our blogs, we get a little cut of the action. You pay the same price, but it helps support the blogger as well. So regardless of how you want to support us, we're thankful for it. Please remember the five most important words in the English language.
Hit the freaking tip jar.
Yes, please.
Folks, John, let me interrupt the flow of the podcast.
Oh, we have got something fun?
Yes. Today in New York City, there was a march against white nationalism in New York City. And the headline on the poster is, "End the Violence Toward Asians." Okay, let's unite against white nationalism. This has to do with the murder of... in San Francisco, of 84-year-old Visha Ratanapakti. Okay?
That sounds
Indonesian?
Like...
Visha.
Indonesian?
Right. Yeah. Well, the point is, the person who killed that who committed that racial crime, and I don't know if it was a hate crime or not. Well, but the teen facing murder pleads not guilty in death of elder. Antoine Watson is held in attack on 84-year-old victim.
Oh, Antoine Watson. He must be a Cajun.
He doesn't look like a white supremacist to me. I'm just going to say this.
But Antoine's a good Cajun name.
But you see, these attacks on Asians, okay, in urban America, are not being perpetrated by white nationalists.
See, there you go, bringing facts into it.
Yes, yeah, that's
facts are inherently racist, apparently.
Obviously, so, yes. Anyways, wait, but I just had to throw that in there. This has just gotten out of control. That everything is white supremacy now. Math is white supremacy. History is white supremacy.
Not really, no.
Radio is white supremacy.
Oh, God. Oh, God. I'm so sorry. Here we go. Oh, no. You know, I have been following the horrible things that being said about Rush Limbaugh. And considering I listened to him for years, and occasionally kind of cringed because he did occasionally say things that made my teeth itch. His point was almost always solid, and it wasn't racist. It may have been harsher than I would have been, but he wasn't a racist, and he wasn't a misogynist, and he wasn't any of the things they keep trying to say he was. Anyway, shall we go on to our actual prepared remarks?
Yes. I had up a post. I just called it Rush Limbaugh, R.I.P. Rest in peace. Rasquiat in what?
Requiescat in pace.
Yes, right.
Unless you speak church Latin, which I don't. I speak classical Latin.
Okay. Well, anyways. Mark Stein had a great tribute to him, and he pointed out that Rush's audience was over half the total Republican vote. Okay, he had tens of millions of listeners, and about three or four times in my career as a journalist, Rush actually read my stories on the air. And one of the reasons I called my blog The Other McCain is because my last name was McCain, right?
Noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, because my last name is McCain, his hatred, and which I shared, by the way, of John McCain, I remember him leaning over the microphone, asking snurdly, right, if I was some kin to John McCain, yeah. But anyways, three or four times.
You're something like third cousins, aren't you?
We are like sixth cousins. Okay. It goes back.
Well, I'm my own sixth cousin, so it could. We're stranger things can happen.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. My family tree is not necessarily forked all the way.
But if
it's
you
a
have
triangle.
Well, no, basically, I've descended from two families that were here before the revolution, and after five generations, cousins married.
Yeah, well, yes, but meanwhile, the thing is, about three or four times, Rush actually read my stories on the radio, and I would get calls or messages on Facebook from friends I hadn't heard from in years, going, "Man, I heard you on Rush." And it was a big deal. It was like having one of your stories get a Drudge hit. I mean, it was huge. It really, Rush made a difference, and people just have no idea. He was so good and innovative. What his use of actualities, as they're called, or sound bites, was what really set him apart. Apart from that great baritone voice of his, which he could modulate, he could go high or he could go low. He used the full range of his voice.
Well, and he was an excellent entertainer. but he was also a thoughtful commentator. And the intersection of those two things
My wife just came in the door.
And the dog's greeted.
The dog had to bark at her.
Yes.
Ginger had to say hello.
Yes, that was Ginger, as a matter of fact. You're learning to tell them apart, I see.
Oh, yeah, gosh, Ginger's the
but anyway,
yappy little thing.
Yes.
Marley is the big dog.
But, you know, that was, and he was something a lot of other people, a lot of people who were doing talk radio 35 years ago were quick-witted, and they were sharp, but they weren't funny.
Mm-hmm.
And Rush made you laugh.
God, yes.
Rush could make his point using humor, and that was one of the things that made him so effective and so hated by the people on the other side of the argument with him, because he was just absolutely devastating.
Because they're very angry and consumed by hatred. Yes.
Right.
There was a lot of envy toward Rush. And because with the exception, I would guess, of Sean Hannity, very few radio DJs did what Rush did, which is to get rich. Okay. I mean, he signed, I forget what year it was, but
$25 million. I believe 2000.
Anyways, he signed a 10-year contract, and I remember being at CPAC, and a DJ, a talk host that I like, a guy that I know, was just bitching. I mean, about that Rush doesn't care, and we're talking about how bad the audience was and the advertising is not there and stuff. But the fact is that your local talk radio host doesn't make if they make $75,000 a year, they're doing good.
When I was doing it in Nashville, I was making only twice minimum wage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was one of the highest paid people at on the air at the station.
Well, it is a fact that, I mean, because so many people, the kids especially, okay, are all about the Spotify playlist and they're, if they listen to anything, they're listening to podcasts
Well, that's not such a bad thing.
Well, yeah. I don't think a lot of the kids are downloading us. They probably should, but kids, parents, send this podcast to your kids. Tell them to listen
to
us.
But look, here's the point.
Here are the old folks talking.
Rush had a significant impact on American culture. He was on the radio, nationally syndicated for over 30 years. And he deeply influenced from time to time our public debate because he was clever and he was humorous, but he made his point. And that effectiveness really did cause people to either love him or to hate him. And sometimes he would frame an entire debate with like a word or a phrase. I mean, like, here's, and I think the champion word of all of them is probably feminazi.
Feminazi.
That word.
I don't know, that and the new castrati, but between the feminazi and the new castrati, I kind of.
Well,
the feminazi is a term that is so charged now. Mm-hmm. It's so verboten that when I was typing it into my blog, I had to fight with autocorrect just to let me type the word.
Yeah, I'll say this about the word feminazi. Okay, it makes people, the people that hate Rush Limbaugh, and not all of whom are liberals, by the way. Michael Brendan Doherty just lit himself on fire. It was like one of these Buddhist monks self-immolating in Saigon back in the day. It was like, and by the way, I know Michael Brendan Daugherty. I've had beers with Michael Brendan Daugherty, and I know him to be an intelligent person and a thoughtful conservative, but he just cut his own throat, and right. Everybody lit him up. But the point I was getting to, I have completely forgotten.
So
now.
I'll go pick up with mine again.
Yes.
No, this whole,
oh, wait, feminazi. Okay, now I remember what it was. Okay, it sounds like just a slur, an epithet. But folks, you know how much work I did on radical feminism. And I will tell you this. Okay, what Rush was talking about the totalitarian strain of feminism is that man, the male, is to feminism what the Jew was to Hitler. Okay. It's just that's all there is to
it. And that's the point. In making that one little coined word, he takes this one group of feminists, not all feminists, mm-hmm. but this one particular group of totalitarian Marxist mm-hmm. feminisms, and just wraps the whole thing up in one neat word. It's just a wonderfully terse summary of their whole attitude and way of doing things. And that's why they hate him, because he was that good. I really admired Rush Limbaugh. On the other hand, not everyone did. There was a piece that Al Franken had up at the Daily.
Why do you remind me of his existence?
Anyway, I'm so old that the whole complaint in Franken's piece was that
what
Rush is more successful.
That I don't have
talent. I can remember when the left really had a significant, maybe often dominant share of talk radio, and that began to change in the Reagan era. And by the time Rush got on to national syndication at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, with the Clintons coming into the national political scene, the AM band basically flipped and it became conservative. And that was that. And now we've got FM as well, but that's beside the point of what I'm making. Part of the left's response to Rush was an outfit that you may remember called Air America. And that Sadly. Included Al Franken, actually, as one of their headliners. And at that point, he was a minor league comedy writer and occasional Saturday Night Live player. He basically was about the only person who came out of Air America with anything intact. He managed then to get into the Senate through Minnesota through a rigged election. But he failed there, too, the same way Air America failed. So, Rush has consistently held on to tens of millions of listeners. And basically, people just don't like Franken.
Surprise there.
Folks are wondering who's going to replace Rush. Beats me. But somebody will. I'm reasonably certain that there's someone who's going to come along who's funny and effective, and who the left will just love to hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing is that the left won't bother to hate you as long as you fail. Okay,
or they think they can hurt you badly enough that you'll go away. I mean, look at this thing that the New York Times just pulled on Scott Alexander.
Yes.
No,
by the way,
he wasn't towing the line.
He offended the party. I had a post Sunday, as a matter of fact, called New York Times doxes Scott Alexander because they hate free speech. And Slate Star Codex, if you're not familiar with it, is a blog that is really about computer geeks. Okay, it's about
it's a Bay Area thing. Most people wouldn't understand.
Yeah, it's a lot of computer geeks and venture capitalists, and it involves a lot of talk about artificial intelligence and the theoretical development of that. But because it's considered must reading among many in Silicon Valley, it attracted the attention of the New York Times because at a few points, Scott Alexander, which is the name used by the host of Slate Star Codex, at a few times, he said things that suggested that he was open to ideas that are not approved by the social justice warriors. Okay, so that in terms of differences among different groups of people, possibly explaining certain phenomenon that we're supposed to believe is all about oppression.
You mean the fact that I'm oppressed because I'm 5'8" and I can't play in the NFL?
Things like that.
Let alone the NBL.
Basically, to say nothing of your age, my friend. Sorry, John, but you know, I really don't like the thought of you facing an offensive lineman.
Imagine me gardening Shaquille O'Neal, you know.
Yeah. Anyways, but what they did, and they did several things. Part of what it was is that some of the stuff at Slate Star Codex ended up quoted essentially and then attributed in the who was that guy at Google that got fired? The engineer.
James Damore.
That some of the stuff from Slate Star Codex about the differences between men and women in terms of their interest in the field of computer science and why that explains the relative paucity of women in the field. But you see,
that's verboten knowledge, because if you go and look at societies like Scandinavia, where you have the minimum amount of people being forced into gendered roles, women choose to go into professions like medicine, and men choose to go into careers like engineering. Funniest things that the biological evolution for a million years drives people who are in a caretaker role into caretaking activities, and those of us who are into other roles into other roles. How science works.
Anyways, they did what he called the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon style thing to try to link him to certain pro-Trump figures in Silicon Valley, including Peter Thiel. And he points out, you know, Alexander said, look, he's a liberal. He doesn't support Trump. He voted for Elizabeth Warren in the primaries, voted for Biden on Election Day. And yet, because he doesn't, you know, he's not going to exclude these people. He's not going to suppress their free speech. Therefore, he's part of the problem. And
yes, absolutely. You can't have it. I mean, the next thing you know, we'll have people actually writing things they believe in.
Yeah. And that links and ties thing, I talked about how that's been done to me. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how it's been done to others, that mm-hmm. if someone that you know, gets in trouble, I'll put it to you that way, if they do something wrong, if they offend the woke police, they may actually commit a crime or whatever, but then your association with them will be used to portray you as complicit in their wrongdoing, even though A, you didn't know what they were doing, and B, you certainly would not have approved of what they did if they had, you know, asked your advice. This is about the, think about the Capitol riots, for instance.
Actually, I'd more rather think about a certain trial where the SPLC just couldn't be brought into evidence.
It used
to be that silly.
And it's just this idea that this links and ties stuff,
but it destroys people's lives.
Yes.
And it does, Diana. You had a piece you wanted to talk about.
As some of you are aware, I am a huge science fiction fan. And one of the publishers that I have appreciated and loved for years now, three, four decades, is Bain Books.
Absolutely.
Now, Jim Bain has passed, and Tony Weisskopf is the current editor, editor-in-chief, publisher, whatever you want to call her. Anyway, she's the person in charge. She is brilliant, and she is tough-minded, and she is a free speech fanatic. Now, there is a forum called Bain's Bar. Now, Bain's Bar is, in terms of modern internet stuff, basically it's a little tiny forum for fans and maybe some authors. It's not really very, it's tiny. Honestly, I haven't been on it in years. Even my husband, who used to...
What you're talking about? What?
Bain's Bar.
BAEN'SBAR. Don't worry about it too much. But anyway, this person, an author of whom I have never heard, whose work I have never read, by the name of Jason Sanford, had the published a hit piece, an ugly, ugly hit piece, saying that Bain's Bar, this little tiny internet forum, is a site for the incitement of political violence. Oh my God. And the piece he wrote is a lie. It's full of lies, flat out lies, by the way, smears, innuendos, half quotes, quotes out of context, elided quotes. Essentially,
what you're talking about there, a friend of mine who was smeared by the Southern Poverty Law Center called this the ransom note method of quotation, where they take a sentence here and half a sentence there and a phrase there. They never will quote as much as a whole paragraph.
They just clip it up and glue it together on another sheet of paper.
Correct.
Hence ransom note.
Anyway, as a result of this awful nonsense, Tony Weisskopf had been invited to be a guest of honor at Worldcon, DISCOM this year. When this hit piece came out and the coordinated campaign came out trying to deplatform the entirety of Bain Books, Tony was suddenly disinvited as guest of honor, a thing that Worldcon has never done. Larry Correa at Monster Hunter Nation has a really angry open letter up. If you have troubles with profanity, don't read this. Larry drops F-bombs at least twice per paragraph in this. But his point is absolutely valid. Cancel culture has gotten completely out of hand. They go after anybody who even believes in free speech. Bain Books publishes Eric Flint, who is a Trotskyite. And I'm not kidding. He actually says he is. Yes, they also published Tom Crapman, who would cheerfully throw anybody who voted Democrat into the fire.
You like say Tom. That like it's a bad thing.
I like Tom Crapman. I like him a lot. Okay. I occasionally
think so you were endorsing the throwing into the fire meme. Okay, okay.
Not
we
really.
Got you on record there.
Well, yeah, not but they, really. I but, just really but, like Tom Crapman.
Well, Bain also
he has a
also,
barren garden in which he grows his care.
Yeah, I am just becoming acquainted with
Well,
this.
Bain also publishes other authors that, you know, have got
Larry
some
Correa,
traction.
John Ringo, David
Hoyt,
Weber.
Sarah Hoyt.
Sarah Hoyt, Lois McMaster-Bajold, late Mercedes Lackey.
Basically, almost everybody I've read over the last decade.
I hope you haven't read Mercedes Lackey. She really isn't very good.
Well, no, but I mean, George R. R. Martin. I mean, you know.
I'm just reading Jason Sanford's.
I mean, they don't have him currently.
Sanford was evidently, I am told, and this is gossip, nothing else. I am told that Sanford had submitted a piece that was a book that was declined by Bain just prior to this. On the other hand, we're pretty sure he got paid for this, and the coordinated hit looks like Tor Books. But that's gossip. Pure gossip. Nothing more.
Oh, he went to Auburn. That explains it. I'm just reading his
Roll
Wikipedia
tide,
page there, and of course this communist who wants to suppress free speech and hates America went to Auburn University.
Yeah, well, but the point is that this is
and after going to Auburn he joined the Peace Corps.
The point that she's got going here is that this is something that's metastasizing throughout society. It isn't just politics, you know, like, you know, it gets said over and over again, culture is upstream of politics, politics downstream of culture. And this is a cultural institution that is just being whipped left and right.
You know, the only thing Toni did wrong in all of this was that she took down the bar for even 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Seriously. Free speech is free speech. Stand up for it.
Yeah. Well, we do that, and that's part of what we do here in the blog is we speak freely. And we also ask the difficult questions about crazy people who are dangerous.
Okay.
Sometimes we want to know why they aren't behind bars already.
Yeah. I've got one of the things, and by the way, I apologize for any blog readers for the relative shortage of new content in the past few weeks, but I've been going through a phase, I guess is the best way to put it. But
and the phaser was set on stun, folks.
But I routinely cover crime stories. True crime is has been a lifelong interest of mine, going back to in my freshman English composition class. We were assigned Truman Capote's In Cold Blood as a perfect example of how novelistic technique could be used to tell true stories. Okay, and so
did you ever read any Tom Wolfe?
yeah, Tom Wolfe, Hunter S. Thompson, but yes, I read all of those in college, and so. So the idea of crime as an interesting subject matter has always interested me. Well, Leonard Ortega of Seattle was a lifelong criminal was out on the street earlier this month. Police say Ortega pulled a shotgun on 68-year-old Phil Salmon and stole his pickup truck Wednesday morning, February 3rd, from a Chevron gas station. Fortunately, he got the truck without without killing anyone. But he led them on a led police on a chase through the streets of Seattle that ended down along with a huge crash on the waterfront that ended in his arrest. Okay. So he has, and this is in the story, he had a lengthy criminal history, including 7 felony convictions, such as being in possession of a stolen gun and stealing cars. Police say they're investigating him for multiple cases, not only in Seattle, but in other cities as well. But now questions are being asked about why a judge released him last month after he was arrested for allegedly stealing an empty FedEx truck. But yeah, they're just turning criminals loose. And I cite a story, a headline in the Washington Post from a couple of years ago. In the past decade, nearly 26,000 murders have gone without an arrest in major American cities. Of those, more than 18,600 of the victims, almost three quarters, were black. Oh, wait. And what about the perpetrators of these murders? Oh, you see, this idea that leniency toward criminals, okay, is social justice, you know, this is crazy, okay? And crazy people are dangerous.
This case, we're not talking about the crazy person in the form of the guy who pulls a shotgun. We're going to talk about the crazy person in the form of the judge.
Yeah. And these crimes like this are taking place, if you pay attention, on a daily basis, okay, in America, that people who are out on bond, out on parole, whatever, people who could have been kept behind bars are being turned loose, and people are suffering from this crime wave, this social justice crime wave. And so we will continue to pay attention. But meanwhile, next week at 7 o'clock, usual time, we will be back with the other podcast. But I hear that boogie woogie in the background that tells me it's about time for us to get out of here.
Yep, it's about time. We'll see you all next week.
Good and night. Down in Valdosta, y'all be good.
We will.
All right, we'll see you, folks.
And if we can't be good, we'll be careful.
Yes, indeed.
Mr. Breeze.